from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. If you opened up a plastic food container this morning or grabbed a bottle of water or shampooed your hair, odds are decent that you might have come in contact with two common chemicals, bisphenol A, sometimes referred to as BPA, and methylparaben. Both chemicals have been associated with certain health issues in the past. But this month, researchers at California Pacific Medical Center published a study which raises additional concerns. The researchers found that when healthy breast tissue cells are exposed to BPA or methylparaben, they can begin to grow like cancer cells. And what's more, those chemicals can also inhibit the effectiveness of certain cancer drugs like tamoxifen. So in this half hour of Forum, we want to take up the significance of these findings. Joining us to do that, Dr. William Goodson. He's Senior Clinical Research Scientist at the California Pacific Medical Center Research Institute and a board-certified breast surgeon. Dr. Goodson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And joining us as well is Victoria Colliver, healthcare reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, who's been reporting on this issue. Victoria, thanks for being with us as well.
Good to be here.
So let's start out by just a quick understanding of what BPA and methylparaben are and where we find them. Dr. Goodson, what exactly are these chemicals?
BPA is a chemical that's used as a plasticizer. It's found in polycarbonate plastic, which is ubiquitous. I mean, your DVDs, your CDs, your eyeglasses are all made with polycarbonate
plastic. So it's not just food containers. It's much more widespread and ubiquitous than that.
The widest use of it is not in food containers.
Okay.
But you get it in the plastic water bottles, although a lot of people have gotten away from BPA in water bottles. You also get it in the lining of cans. If you look at a canned food item and look and see that lining on the inside, it's an epoxy, and BPA is part of what makes it be the plastic that will stick there.
And Victoria Colliver, is it easy to find products that don't have it, or how do you know when you go and grab something off the shelf whether or not there's BPA in that particular container or that particular DVD or CD?
I think in a lot of cases we don't know. More and more companies are starting to label products BPA-free, and I think that with the growing number of studies and research like Dr. Goodson's, the public is becoming more and more aware and starting to demand this information.
We've heard a lot about BPA in particular over the last few years, but this seems to kind of up the ante on what may be at stake. Tell us in brief, if you would, Dr. Goodson, what your research found about the impact that BPA and this other chemical, methylparaben, have on breast tissue cells, rather.
Well, what's different about our study is that we looked at cells right after they came out of human volunteers. It's all done with the multi-page consent forms. And there are some specific characteristics that cells have to have in order to become malignant, in order to have cancer. One of them is that the cells need to grow when they would otherwise be slowing down, and the other one is that they need to die when they get certain kinds of signals. And what we found was that cells that have been exposed to BPA or methylparaben in very tiny concentrations continued to grow when they should not be growing and did not die when they should die. I mean, growing and dying are actually two separate processes in cells, and both of those processes were influenced. And the reason this is important is because these are processes that have to occur in a cancer cell, otherwise it's not cancer.
So it basically flips a switch within the cell? It's like turning on a circuit breaker?
It turns a cell in the direction that you don't want it to go. It's not sufficient in itself, but if the cell has to acquire these capabilities, and it usually does this kind of on a random basis, if you give the cell those capabilities, then the cell is already heading in a direction we don't like.
And is that the same reason, then, that it inhibits the effectiveness of a drug like tamoxifen?
Yeah, well, the way we tested this is that we exposed normal cells to tamoxifen. And tamoxifen, I'm not advocating tamoxifen to prevent breast cancer, but if you use it as a preventative, what it does is actually causes normal cells to die, and it causes normal cells to stop growing. And so we use tamoxifen as our test to see what was happening to these cells. And, you know, we were saying, okay, this is what we find. And then we stopped and thought about it and realized, gee whiz, tamoxifen is this very common drug, and we use it a lot. And it's not working as well as we would expect it to.
So what can you sort of distill from this? Does this mean, for example, that someone who is being treated for breast cancer with tamoxifen is going to find that drug less effective if they have BPA or methylparaben in their system?
It's really hard to answer that in a very specific form because it's almost impossible to do a research project that will do that for the simple reason that we're all part of what you could call a great big giant research project with no control group because we all swim in BPA all the time. It's possible to get BPA out of your system, and I think that when you sit back and consider this, that this kind of information is the strongest argument for saying that people who have cancer or want to avoid cancer probably should try to think about the packaging of what they're getting food in, because that's where it all comes from.
Dr. William Goodson joins us. He's the senior clinical research scientist at the California Pacific Medical Center Research Institute, led this study about the importance of or the possible importance of how BPA and methylparaben affect breast cancer, breast cells. Victoria Colliver at the San Francisco Chronicle, how does this play into the wider debate that you've been covering in recent years over BPA? Are we at sort of a tipping point yet with the way in which people view BPA and the way in which perhaps there will be legislation? There is a bill now on the governor's desk that would ban BPA in tippy cups and baby bottles. Is this something that sort of clocks us over to the other side?
Well, I think it's really part of a growing body of research that has shown that BPA and in this case methylparaben as well are bad actors. It's interesting because California has been typically at the forefront of a lot of health and environmental legislation, and we've actually there's been bills proposed for a long time, so it's not for lack of trying, but this is the first time that a bill has actually reached the governor's desk to ban BPA from sippy cups and whatnot. It's failed for the past couple years in the legislature, mostly, I believe, due to the chemical industry's lobbying efforts. So far, now 10 other states nationwide have passed similar legislation. We're looking at other countries, Canada, the EU, and incidentally, even China has this year passed something that would ban it from, I think it is, once again, children's products.
Victoria Colliver, healthcare reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle, joining us along with William Goodson from the California Pacific Medical Center Research Institute. If you have questions or concerns about the exposure to BPA or methylparaben, what that might mean for the prospects of being treated for breast cancer or the possibility that it would also make one more vulnerable to breast cancer, you can give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. You can go to our Facebook page, or you can just go online at kqed.org/forum and add your comments or concerns there. What do we know about how much exposure is too much exposure? How careful, I guess, Dr. Goodson, should one be at this point? What's the state of our knowledge about how often you should handle or not handle a water bottle or anything else? Do we know how much is too much?
Well, first of all, in terms of handling products with our hands for like bisphenol A, it's very unlikely that you're going to absorb that from your CD or your water bottle or something like that. It's really the things that you ingest that have been stored in containers that have BPA. The difficulty in this is that the data comes from a variety of sources. One of the sources is studies done by the U.S. government in which they actually did urine samples. Like you do drug tests, they did BPA tests. And like 95% of Americans have BPA in their urine at any given time. The Canadians this last actually summer a year ago published a similar study. And one of the things that came out of that is that the average was about 91% positive. The people who are over 60, it dropped to about 70%. And the young people, it was about 95%.
And what would be the difference, reason for the difference?
It's thought to be related to the types of products that kids are affiliated with and the types of products that kids ingest food from and things like that. So that the older people, I think, just don't tend to eat the same kind of things.
There's a question that was just emailed in this quotes the World Health Organization as saying that bisphenol A is mostly eliminated and does not accumulate in the body. There's another report that came out from the EPA, Victoria Colliver, making that same point, which would tend to think, well, gee, maybe I don't have to worry as much. Help us understand that part of this equation.
It's interesting. About 6 months ago, I covered a study that was funded in part by the Breast Cancer Fund, I believe, or partnered with them. They looked at five families. It was very small, and just took BPA out of their whole lives for about 3 days. And it was really interesting because the levels of BPA dropped dramatically. I mean, they had to remove everything, all their containers. They couldn't even touch food with a piece of plastic. And I think that speaks to Dr. Goodson's point. This is metabolized very quickly, but we're swimming in it all the time. And incidentally, the Breast Cancer Fund is coming out with another report next week that looks at foods marketed to kids and adolescents and the BPA levels in that. I haven't seen the study yet, but it's, once again, part of this growing body of research.
Can you put this in some perspective, Dr. Goodson, about all of the things that we have to be aware of in terms of our health and the role that the environment obviously plays in our overall health? Would you rank this fairly high in your priority of things to be concerned about?
I think the whole question of chemicals is something that's a really high priority. It's something that I sort of stumbled to about 10, 12 years ago. What you have to try to explain is why breast cancer has gone up in the last 30, 35 years. The good data really starts in 1972, 73, and breast cancer in women's gone up at a very constant rate over the next 30 years. Now, there's a little drop after we dropped off in hormone replacement therapy, but that's not really much of a drop. The part that people don't talk about is that the rate of breast cancer has gone up the same proportion in men. Now, men have a lot less breast cancer than women, but the proportionate increase has been almost the same. It's just women go up a little bit more than 1% a year, men a little bit less than 1% a year.
And the significance of that, then, is that there must be something in play besides hormones?
Well, you can't blame hormone replacement therapy, late childbirth, right, birth control pills, not breastfeeding your kids on men. They don't have that problem, and yet they're getting increased breast cancer. And breast cancer in men is almost entirely a hormone-driven disease.
Lots of questions coming in, so we'll get to our calls in just 1 second. But as you cover this issue and you talk to healthcare professionals, generally speaking, is this sort of up at the top of people's level of concern, Victoria, about the sort of things that you ought to keep out of your household?
BPA has become a clear target for what we should remove. I thought it was interesting because I wasn't really aware of the methylparaben research that Dr. Goodson's being doing. So I think there's a lot of chemicals. We have so many chemicals in society, and we're just starting to grab a few of them that seem to have a body of research behind them. But I'm curious to know, what else is there out there that is causing these rates to increase?
Let's hear what our listeners are concerned about. Let's go to Michael first in Brentwood. Michael, go ahead.
Yes, I have a two-part question. First of all, is there anything we as parents should be doing either to clearly try to limit the exposure of our children to this? And moving forward in the future, as they're getting older, are there things that we should be making sure they're tested for in physicals, additional blood tests, anything like that? And then finally, and this is a ugly question, is, should companies have known better? Is this a classic example of them doing what's financially expedient because they really don't care how it affects the health of their customers?
All right,
and I'll
Michael.
Take my answers off the air.
Yeah, Michael, thanks. Thanks for the question. Dr. Goodson, why don't you take the first two parts? Maybe we'll let Victoria field the last part. But on what parents should do and whether or not they should have additional tests done.
I don't think there is a specific test that – I'll take the easy part. I don't think there's a specific test that you can do that's going to give you any kind of indication. The way most of these things work out is that you have exposures now and you know the differences 25, 30 years down the road. And this is what's happened with DDT. It's what's happened with diethyl stilbestrol, that we have good data, but it takes 20, 30 years to develop that. Things parents should be doing, I think that the place to start out is with little kids and make sure that you get away from plastics and things that they're eating. I'd get away from plastics and things that you cook. I'm a great believer in glass, ceramic materials. I think that they are much safer.
Do we know how this gets leached out? In other words, should you not sort of leave something in a container for a certain length of time? If it's put in the microwave, does that increase how this chemical is exposed?
There excuse me. There is an effect from heating. Because what really happens is that the BPA is part of what makes the plastic, but there are always little tiny bits of BPA loose in the plastic, literally loose in the plastic. If you heat them, they sort of bounce out and get into whatever's in the container.
So don't put those containers in the microwave.
Don't put them in the microwave. The other thing is that stuff that's been in cans for long periods of time, particularly acidic things. The thing that sticks in my mind is that people have looked particularly at tomato-based products. And they're acidic, and they tend to pick up more BPA. But it's found in tuna fish. It's found in a whole variety of things.
So that jar of tomato sauce that says best if used by 2017 or whatever, and it's still on your shelf, is not such a great idea?
Well, the can of tomato sauce, the jar, I think, if it's glass, is probably much safer.
And on the other part of his question about whether or not should companies have known better, any smoking guns along those lines, Victoria?
Well, I just think this plays into the idea that with all these chemicals introduced since World War II, they're generally considered innocent until proven guilty. So it takes a while before these things, the research starts catching up with this. But this is where government policy should come into play. I'm a consumer. I feel like I'm fairly educated, but it takes a lot of work to figure out, does this have BPA? Does this not have BPA? What kind of, you know, and since tent tomato leaches more than other products, how are we supposed to figure these things out?
Let's hear next what Linda would like to figure out. Linda, go ahead, please.
This is a question for mothers feeding infants. Does BPA get into breast milk?
Linda, thank you. Does BPA get into breast milk? Dr. Goodson.
If the mother has a lot of BPA in her blood, BPA has been measured in breast milk so that children and babies are exposed. The blood tests that have really been done most consistently are studies looking at mothers at the time of delivery, looking at blood, looking at the cord blood from the delivery, which is essentially the baby's blood, looking at the placenta, and actually there's even a study looking at levels of BPA in babies who died very, very young, and it's there.
Linda, thanks for the call. Sidel writes in, what happens when you put plastics in the dishwasher? That's heat again,
Well, that water washes away, but what happens is that you get little tiny micro fractures or little tiny micro abrasions on the surface of the plastics, so that plastics which have been used for a while are probably, and I say probably because I can't prove it, but I think that the wear and tear, the little surface cracking you see on the surface means that there's more area that's exposed from which the stuff can leak into the fluids.
Here's a question about methylparabens, which I should have probably been more precise about this, are mostly found right in cosmetics and shampoos,
products,
body lotions, those sorts of things. Is that being studied as much, or as you were saying earlier, Victoria, is this sort of new terrain that's not getting, has not received as much attention?
That was newer for me. I mean, Dr. Goodson can probably answer this more effectively, but I had not been that aware. I mean, obviously BPA is starting in the past few years to become almost a household word, but I don't think it's the same for methylparabens.
And are they in the cosmetics themselves or in the container which is which?
Methylparaben is a preservative that's used to increase the shelf life of products like that. And there isn't anywhere near as much information about methylparaben. The BPA has been studied for a long time, lots of people. What prompted us to look at it was a few studies that were done in cells that showed that BPA actually turned on estrogen receptors, and we thought, wow, we ought to look at that too.
Madeline writes in, I'm taking, and forgive me if I botched the pronunciation here, aromatase inhibitor as a postmenopausal breast cancer survivor. What is the single most important object I might avoid?
Ooh. Well, that's actually probably off into a whole variety of things. The most important thing that you can do for the most important things you can do in terms of making aromatase inhibitors work probably run a variety of things, including limiting alcohol and exercise and keeping your weight down, because those things can undermine the effectiveness of it. The specific relevance to this is that aromatase inhibitors work by blocking the body's production of estrogen. And what we have found is that the bisphenol A and the methylparaben, in fact, work like estrogen. So it's the exposure to these things probably undoes a little bit of the benefit you're getting from the aromatase inhibitor.
And let's get in another call. This comes from Varuna in San Francisco. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. It's great to hear the conversation today.
Go
so
ahead.
My comment is really about the burden that we often put on consumers to keep themselves and their families safe. And while, of course, I'm the executive director here at Breast Cancer Action, of course we encourage individuals to make choices to live as healthily as they can, we need to remove the burden from individuals. Looking at BPA specifically, I know that for many years, many families were using baby bottles that contained BPA before that scientific evidence sort of came into the public mainstream, right? Before, what was it, 2007, 2008, maybe 2007 when we started hearing about it. But many families didn't have access to that information. Furthermore, there's this problem of alternatives to BPA. So right now on the market, you see a lot of plastic baby bottles that talk about being BPA-free. But when you actually look at those bottles, what we see is that in many cases, they also demonstrate estrogenic activity. And so this really gets at, I think, Victoria's point that we need to reform our approach to chemical regulation so that we are not treating chemicals as innocent until proven guilty. All this shift of the burden onto individuals really continues to increase the dramatic inequities that we see, where not everybody has equal access to not only the information, but also the financial resources to make these, quote, safe choices.
And let me hold you there, Varuna, sorry, because we have to take a short break. You are listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. As we've been talking about this new important research about the impact of bisphenol A and methylparaben on breast tissue. But as you know, this is also a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. And for more information about how to support KQED, you should go to kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson. Another email coming in from Poppy writes, how can we detect BPA or methylparaben in plastic? Can we use the recycling number as a clue? This gets to also the point that Varuna was making, I guess, Victoria Colliver. How much detective abilities, I guess, do we need in order to figure out whether or not something contains this?
Actually, there has been some work on that, and there are certain numbers that do have lower levels of BPA. When you flip over the container, you'll see one of those triangle things and a number. Can't remember them offhand, but there has been – the paper has done stories on this as well.
Dr. Goodson?
BPA is actually a number 7 plastic. The curious thing is that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 are very specific plastics. Number 7 is – quote, other, unquote. Now, BPA falls into this, so that all number 7s are not BPA, but BPA falls into number 7.
So although you might be sort of casting a wider net than might be necessary, if you avoided products with number 7 on the bottom, you'd be avoiding both BPA and methylparaben?
No, methylparaben is a totally different thing. It's intentionally put into as you said, shampoo, cosmetics, sunscreen, it's put there into the liquid phase to preserve it. And therefore, when you use the liquid phase, you are putting that on your skin.
Okay. But in terms of the BPA part, at least, that's one way we can know. You might be ruling out some other things, too.
Right.
But you'd at least be ruling out BPA if you avoided containers with number 7. That's
correct.
Useful. Jen writes in, I use a lot of canned products. Does rinsing, like rinsing canned beans, for example, does that reduce the amount of BPA content?
My understanding, and just doing the story about the foods, the various foods, that certain foods, especially if they're high in acids, just absorb the BPA from the lining of the cans more effectively, if you will. And I think beans, anyway, in the process of doing so, there are like certain foods and lists and which ones are more likely than others to absorb it. But I think it's a little more than rinsing. It actually becomes part of the food and difficult to remove.
Back to shampoos for a moment. Usam Rasen, do we need to stop using shampoo and conditioner? Is there an alternative?
There's paraben-free shampoo. I mean,
And is that as hard to figure out as we were talking about with BPA, or can you more readily discern that?
You can read the fine print on the back. And the fine print on the back, usually methylparaben is about the fourth or fifth item from the end. If you have an inch of ingredients, it's about the fourth or fifth from the end. And you can find methylparaben-free products. They're a little hard to find. I know they're available at the Institute for Health and Healing in San Francisco because that's where I buy paraben-free shampoo. I think that you can find them online. My daughter tells me that one of the cosmetic manufacturers actually makes a paraben-free brand of cosmetics, but I don't remember which one that was.
I would think that industry would be all over this at this point, Victoria, particularly in an area like this, that there would be a ready market for BPA-free or methylparaben-free products. Is that coming to be true?
There are some companies that are making their business in organic and chemical-free products, and there's a number of websites that list the ingredients of different products. If consumers, once again, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
But the information is out there. Not all the information we need, though.
Here's a question about what this tells us, perhaps, about other cancers. Given the cellular process involved with creating cancerous cells, do you think, Dr. Goodson, it's likely that not only breast cancers might be increased through exposure to BPA, but also other cancers?
Difficult question. A lot of speculation on that at this point. One of the things that is really fascinating is that although all the different cells in the body, in theory, have the same genes, by the time something gets to be a breast cell or a skin cell or a liver cell, some of those genes and how they work are turned off and on, so that we can say this fairly specifically to estrogen responsive cells, which seems to be what breast tissue is. The other place where this comes into play is the concerns about whether or not these things might have some effect on development in the fetus before it's actually born. Particularly questions about whether or not there are aspects of brain development that are hormone receptor dependent.
We have to hold things there, but just real briefly, what are you going to examine next? I mean, are you going to dig more deeply into this topic?
We're digging more deeply into what BPA does with cells. We're looking at its mechanism more because the skeptics need to have a mechanism.
We'll leave it there. Dr. William Goodson, senior clinical research scientist who led this most recent study. He's with the California Pacific Medical Center Research Institute. Dr. Goodson, thanks very much for joining us today. Thanks, too, to Victoria Colliver, healthcare reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Victoria, thank you.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory, Tina Larberg, and Judy Campbell. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.